Hello and welcome to lesson number 15, and this is going to be titled Neurolinguistic Programming Ideas Based on Milton Erickson. This is lesson 15 in our Ericksonian Hypnotherapy training, and I am Dr. Richard Nonyard with SubliminalScience.com. I am excited that you have made it this far. I have some great things in this session for you to practice, and I'm really looking forward to sharing this information with you. Now, neurolinguistic programming, as I've explained earlier, is really an outgrowth of Richard Bandler studying Milton Erickson. The real question of neurolinguistic programming is, why are effective people effective? Milton Erickson was identified as being one of those psychiatrists who was effective, not only because he used hypnosis, but because of his approach to therapy, the way he interacted with clients, and the way he communicated with them, that really were, particularly at that time, completely different than the way other people worked with clients and the viewpoint that they had. And so neurolinguistic programming built its patterns or its protocols on modeling effectiveness and modeling Milton Erickson. And some of the most effective strategies in neurolinguistic programming come directly from the ideas of Milton Erickson, or the techniques of Milton Erickson, or really Richard Bandler and John Grinder's evaluation or observation of how it was that he worked. Now, earlier in my interview with Scott Sandlin via Skype, he talked about submodalities as a tool in pain management. I wanted to expand on that a little bit more. We have our primary representational system, you know, kind of what we see, what we hear, and what we feel. But submodalities are really a refinement of each of these primary representational systems. In other words, when it comes to visual imagery or visualization, well, we have color. We have the size of something. We have whether we're seeing it close or whether we're seeing it far. These are all examples of the submodalities. The primary modality, representational system, is sensorial experience is visual. Those are the submodalities to it. Auditory, for example. Not just hearing things, but what's really the quality of it? What's the submodality of the auditory sensorial process? Is it loud? Is it soft? Again, is it near? Is it far? What's the rate? What's the pitch? All examples of submodalities related to the auditory. Kinesthetic, tactile, feeling things. Well, the submodalities, of course, is it rough? Is it smooth? Is it wet? Is it dry? There are probably an unknown or unlimited number of potential answers for what the submodalities of each of these primary representational systems are. And the less than primary representational systems, olfactory, gustatory, what's the quality of the smell? Is it, you remember the scratch and sniff books? When you first get them, when you're a kid, and you scratch, and the whole room smells like pine cones. But a year or two later, or 5 or 10 years later, you pick up that same book and you can scratch and scratch and scratch, and the scent is only faint. Some modalities of taste. Is it salty? Is it sweet? So these are really the specific understandings or descriptors of each of the primary representational systems. And they are, or they encompass, our experience and our interpretation of what that primary representational system is really all about. And submodalities are important, not just because they exist and are great descriptors, but because submodalities have meaning. For example, in a horror movie, there may be a high-pitched sound. That high-pitched sound equals perhaps certainty, or that high-pitched sound indicates trepidation, or that high-pitched sound represents we're about to get to the point where the monster jumps out, or whatever it is. Hollywood filmmakers understand the importance of submodalities in altering our emotional states and our feelings. By moving the image close, or moving the image far, or making the image color, or taking the color out of the image. Think about the movie The Wizard of Oz, how powerful that was. Remember the opening scene of the original Wizard of Oz movie. And by the way, I think the Tim Burton remake of another one of those books in the trilogy, I can't remember what that was called, start out in black and white. And only when they get to Oz is there color. The state changes. The feeling changes by changing the submodality. Submodalities really are, for all practical purpose, the code in our linguistic programs. And language is important because, well, as we've been studying, this is the way we elicit responses to the world around us. This is how we describe our world in the world around us. And submodalities create subjective subdivisions between one experience and another. Now, why is this important to the therapist? This is important to the therapist because, as Scott described, we can change a person's entire experience by taking a few minutes to change the submodalities, to have them look at things from a new vantage point with a different experience. I'm going to be flying tomorrow, and so I'm going to share with you a couple examples of dealing with submodalities around the subject of fear of flying. I actually used to be afraid to fly. I would not get on an airplane. I spent about 10 years driving whenever I had to go somewhere and really not leaving the Midwest. I was on an emergency. Actually, it was worse than an emergency landing and less severe than a crash. I call it a flop, and that's how my phobia of flying developed. Now, you know, I no longer am afraid to fly. In fact, I have been executive platinum on American Airlines for years. That's the highest level of status. I fly on a regular basis. And tomorrow I'm going to be flying. I'm going to be flying on Southwest Airlines. And a lot of people are afraid to fly. See, there's that Freudian slip. I love to fly now, but a lot of people are afraid to fly. And they come see me for fly-a-phobia treatment, if you will. And I love working with these folks. By the way, this is a perfect example to talk about self-disclosure. When my clients ask me to help them with their fear of flying, I do not always share with them that I too used to be afraid to fly. This can actually set up the reverse effect than desired. I might say, well, I too used to be afraid to fly, and I used hypnotic technique to overcome my fear of flying, which I did. And then my clients, if they don't have the same responses or the same enthusiasm for flying as I do, say, well, I'm not like Richard. I must not be over my flyophobia. So although my prior experiences inform the work that I do, that's not what makes me an expert. What makes me an expert is the same thing that makes you an expert. Those of you who are participating in this course, you've studied, you've taken time, you've practiced. And because of this, you're able to work with anybody, even if their experiences or interpretations are actually different than ours. So I love working with people who have a flyophobia. It means they can visit their grandchildren. It means they can continue in that employment. I mean, there are all kinds of great things about helping clients with flyophobia. But let's talk about the submodalities. When I have somebody who comes in the office and is afraid to fly, I'm going to ask them, what happens when you step onto that airplane and find your seat? Describe for me what that is like. What's it like on the jet bridge? You're waiting in the line, you get onto the plane, you move down the aisle, and you find your seat. Describe for me that process, what your experience is, what you're feeling, what you're thinking, what you're sensing, and then I just shut up and I listen to them. And what they're going to tell me is usually they're visualizing the plane crashing or the plane having some other problem, or they're hearing in their mind a committee talking about whether or not flying is safe or unsafe, or you know, this or that, or they're hearing images of, or, you know, or hearing sounds of, you know, the plane sputtering like the sound of a Hollywood movie plane that's having difficulty. Or my clients, if they're kinesthetic, will tell me, you know, I don't really know what I'm thinking about. I'm usually just zoned out, but I feel this intense pressure. It's almost as if I'm being crushed as soon as I step onto the airplane. And when I sit down on my chair, I begin to feel a little bit better, but then it feels like the top of my body is just sinking into the bottom part of my body. And of course, this would be a very kinesthetic description. So I'm listening for which primary representational system do they associate with the discomfort, the anxiety, or the fear, or the claustrophobia of their experience on the airplane. Then what I'm going to do during my therapy session is I'm going to help them to change their submodalities. I'm going to do this almost always interviewing them. We've done an induction, we've done a deepener, now we're in deep trance, and let's say it was visual imagery. We could do this with auditory approaches, we can do this with kinesthetic approaches. But as my client is, of course, in the safety of my office, I will have them create an image of being on the plane. In fact, you could do this right now. You could pretend you were my client and you were afraid to fly. And so just close your eyes and, in the safety of your home, listening to this MP3, imagine that you're flying on a plane. And the plane hasn't taken off yet. You're still on the ground. People are still coming in. But this is where typically you begin to notice things. Is the plane old? Is the plane new? Is the plane wide, or is it narrow and uncomfortable? You begin to see the people coming on the plane, and traditionally, of course, because you're afraid to fly, you think, wow, each one of them has a story. What will this look like in the movie they make about the plane crash? I've had lots of clients with that thought as they visualize the people coming down the aisle. And so what I do is I have my clients do what I'm going to ask you to do. Simply sit there in your seat. Take in a breath, breathe in and breathe out. And even though you're creating with the imagination the visual imagery of sitting in the plane, you're actually sitting in your chair. You're sitting where it's safe, listening to this MP3. But in your mind, as you view those people coming on the plane, change each one of their images in your own mind to a smile. Maybe even a big silly smile, a super silly grin. So as you see each person walk past you, they all have a big grin rather than that look of grumpiness passengers on a plane usually seem to have, or hurry that they seem to have. That's the nice thing about visualization and hypnosis is you can actually change the imagery to anything you'd like to. It's almost as if you know how to work CGI. It's almost as if you are an expert video editor. And so as the people come on the plane, paint a smile on them. A big, broad, happy smile. Now look at your movie. Is your movie devoid of color, like airplanes usually are? Imagine that you're an executive at Boeing and that you can use mood lighting to create new airplanes that have a new warm and welcoming interior. And so even if your mental image is of a eggshell white 727, put that new modern mood lighting into that airplane, add a blue light and a pink neon light. And a yellow light to that cabin. Imagine everybody coming on, passing through those lights with a smile on their face. Maybe you noticed that the carpeting on the plane was dingy office blue. Put some green, chartreuse. Shag carpeting on that plane. Make it a little bit retro, super fun. Turn those ugly seat covers into seat covers like a teenage girl might put in her car. A leopard print, a zebra print. Making the plane something entirely different than you've ever seen before. Almost like it's a party plane. And of course, if it's a party plane, How would that make you feel? It would make you feel fun, wouldn't it? Everybody likes to be where there's a party, don't they? And that's exactly where you are right now. Because this is only a demonstration in the use of submodalities altering visual imagery, it is time to step off the plane, to stretch out any muscles, to open the eyes, to feel fantastic, and to rejoin this lecture as we continue to talk about other elements of NLP based on the ideas of Milton Erickson. 1, 2, 3, opening the eyes, feeling fantastic. This was just a short example of how I might go through a process of changing the perception of my clients using the submodalities of their primary representational system to alter the way they feel. And of course, NLP, one of the basic tenets is that anytime we do work with our clients, let's check. And so I would have my client open their eyes, just like you open your eyes. And then I would say to my client, now think about being on an airplane tomorrow. Do you feel any less stressed than you did when you first came in here today? Well, the answer to that is yes. I feel less stressed about it. Awesome. Then I am sure you'll do fantastic when it comes time for tomorrow's flight. Let me talk about submodalities as they relate to state change. Now, tomorrow I'm going to be changing state. I'm going to be going from Oklahoma to Nevada. I'm going to Las Vegas. That is not the state change that I am talking about, though. What I'm talking about when I refer to state change is really the praxeological status of a person. And praxeology has the idea of the whole person, body, mind, spirit, every aspect of who a person is, taking into account their experience, their intentions, the whole state of who they are. This could include finances, it could include political, it could include sexual identity, it could include religious identity. The word state in NLP really refers to the gestalt. The gestalt is what Fritz Perls referred to as essentially the now. Those of you who have studied any sort of metaphysical or New Age writing, Eckhart Tolle, the now. That's really what the gestalt is. And of course, this is not a new idea, even though Fritz Perls used that German word gestalt to describe the now. This is the heart of mindfulness meditation, which is, of course, a 5,000-year-old tradition. Every one of us has the ability to self-regulate our state. We have the ability to regulate our intensity of states, the presentation of states, the way that we experience anything, ranging from creativity to commitment, sorrow, love, happiness, success. All of these things are examples of states, not only emotional states, but resource states as well. And in NLP and in my hypnosis practice, I spend a lot of my time training my clients to recognize and utilize the resource states associated with hypnosis. The state of learning, for example. The state of concentration or focus, for example. The state of confidence is a state that I draw my clients' attention to when I do any sort of work with either anxiety or stage fright or sports performance. There's an old saying, you have the same pants to get glad in that you have to get mad in. In other words, something outside of us does not control how we feel. As a psychotherapist working in family therapy, doing marriage counseling, doing really any form of psychotherapy, one of the things that I am accustomed to hearing is clients report that they have what we call an external locus of control. My wife made me feel this way. My husband made me feel this way. My lover made me feel this way. My child made me feel this way. My parent made me feel this way. Nobody else has control over us. We have the ability at all times to self-regulate and to control the intensity and the presence of any state. To many of my clients, this is something that they really weren't even aware of. They always believed that something outside of them dictated how they could feel. That may be a habit that is practiced, but it's a habit that can be broken, and NLP can train people in that skill. And these state change strategies are really outgrowths of Milton Erickson's work. In NLP, a strategy refers to a sequence of representations that lead to an outcome. So in NLP language, when you hear somebody say, here's a strategy, what they're really talking about is a process or a protocol of various representations or various tasks that lead to an outcome. NLP is very process-oriented. And so here is a state change strategy that comes from NLP that really originated in the work of Milton Erickson. And I'm going to go through this process with you. First, identify a current undesired state that you have. Now, although you're doing something enjoyable, listening to lesson number 15 in our series, there's probably other things going on in your world as well. Maybe there's some discontent, irritability, restlessness. Maybe there's something else going on in your world. You can be both happy and satisfied listening to this course and at the same time also feel something else. That's another thing my clients often learn in therapy, that they can have more than one state at the same time. But identify a current undesired state. Now close your eyes for a moment. And by the way, I hear some thunder outside. I have no control over the weather. So if you wonder what that bowling sound is in the background, I'm actually recording apparently in what is a new thunderstorm. But now that you've identified your current state, I want you to close your eyes and I'd like you to identify the active submodalities, the core characteristics of that state. How do you feel it? Is it heavy? Is it tight? How do you see it? Is it close? Is it far? Is it tall? Is it big? Is it red? Is it black and white? How do you hear it? Is it somebody saying something to you? Is it you saying something to somebody else? Is it you talking to yourself? Is it loud? Is it quiet? Is it high-pitched, low-pitched? Is it not a voice, but just a sound? The different submodalities of our primary representational systems, auditory, visual, kinesthetic. Now in the process, you've thought about an undesired state you have, and you've identified those submodalities that describe how you experience it. But now I want you in your own mind, and you can do anything you want to with your own mind, replace those submodalities with the antithesis submodalities. In other words, if you're seeing that undesired state close, move it far. If it's far, move it close. If it's in color, make it black and white. If it's black and white, paint it red, white, and blue. If it's loud, imagine you have a radio knob and you can turn the volume of that voice down or those words down. If it's a low irritant, kind of like background noise, turn it up, listen to it. Whatever your submodalities are, change it and re-experience that same undesired state with an entirely new set of submodalities. What you've actually done here is you've actually created a new scene or a new act or a new script. And imagine that new representation of that undesired state being in front of you with the old scene or the old script in front of that between you and the new one. So from your perceptual position, you have you as you. In the middle, you have the old way of describing that unpleasant scene, and behind it is the antithesis, the new submodalities. Now imagine the old scene, the one in the middle, moving backwards, dissolving into the new scene. Bring that new scene forward. Let the old one continue to disappear off into the distance, leaving only the new scene, the new submodalities for that same experience present. Now think about that undesired state, however you labeled it. Anger, procrastination, frustration, restlessness, irritability, whatever it was. but experience it from the new perspective with the new submodalities and ask yourself this question: in any way, does this feel different? Am I experiencing my undesired state differently than I did before? The answer to that most likely is yes. And this is an example of a strategy for state change that can be adopted and utilized with clients. Let's talk about calibration for a moment. Calibration, most of what we do, most of what we feel, most of what we think, it really is automatic. It comes from our subconscious mind based on our previous experiences. With awareness, though, calibration is the conscious practice of awareness. The intensity and traits of states commonly or uncommonly experienced. It's really a tool for recognition. Calibration is all about understanding what you're experiencing. It is ultimately mindfulness, being fully present in an experience, a state. In therapy, we can use calibration to help us be proactive, to identify those red flags or triggers, the behavior, the emotion, the relationship, or social changes that precede crisis. And we can also, in our lives, calibrate our experiences on a Likert scale. A Likert scale is equal intervals of 1 through 10. For example, how much did you like this training today? On a scale of 1 to 10, rate it. That's called the Likert scale, I guess, after Mr. Likert, who came up with the scale. So I often have my clients scale their anger into perspective. How angry are you on a scale of 1 to 10? I'm a 6. I'm an 8. This is really important because my clients usually are all or nothing. I'm either angry or I'm not angry. I either want a cigarette or I don't want a cigarette. I either want to eat or I don't want to eat. They're all or nothing. But when I help them calibrate their emotions, experiences, and states on a scale of 1 to 10, then they see often for the first time, even though it was clear to others and to me, that they are experiencing things not always the same. And at different levels of experience, I can choose different outcomes, different ways to respond, different ways to interact with people around me. And by scaling things into perspective, I can see that I don't have to take a hammer to attack, which is really important for my clients to understand. You've heard me talk a lot about perceptual positions. And this is really important, particularly for those who are interested in the subject of regression. Perceptual positions and regression certainly are not the same thing. But sometimes people hear me say, I don't regress to cause. That is correct, I don't. I think it's impossible to find the cause of today's problems. In fact, even if there was an originating cause, there's probably many other causes, so many, we probably can't identify them all along the path of life to reinforce that, that it would be impossible to eliminate the causes. And of course, we cannot change the past. But I do some regression work, and this is not about revivification. It's really about looking at the past from a new perspective. And using the perceptual positions of neurolinguistic programming can be a real helpful tool for doing that. The first perceptual position is me experiencing me as me, or more accurately, you experiencing you as you. Right now, you're sitting down, you're listening to this MP3, and you are you as you listening to that. The second perceptual position, though, is where we could step into the role of another person or even another me and see and experience me from outside of me. Again, this is a way for you to step into the role of another person. You, for example, could imagine being me speaking to you, observing you from my perspective. You could imagine another you outside of you, on the other side of the room, watching you listen to this MP3. That would be the second perceptual position. What's the value in this? The value in it is when I move further back from any scene, scenario, setting, or situation, I can see a larger picture in how things relate. In marriage counseling, moving people to the second perceptual position, the point of view of their spouse, is something that is often done. when we see things from this new vantage point, when we see ourselves from this new vantage point of being outside of ourselves, it can give us entirely new perspectives. The third perceptual position is as a detached observer. This is really one level even more removed. This is you watching you, watching you. This is great for self-evaluation. It's a way to see yourself as others see you. When I do work with clients where they're looking at experiences that they've had in the past, what I will often do is have them look at it from a new perceptual position. A distant observer, seeing the whole picture. The picture in relationship to the time that's gone by. The picture in the relationship to the people around them or the others involved. And it gives them clarity about previous experiences and how they've taken those learnings into the present. And that in the case of many of my clients, they can give up on those old ideas, recognizing where they came from and how they might not be so helpful to them. One exercise you can use with clients is to have them identify a situation or conversation that didn't go as planned, and then ask themselves, are they ready to accept change if it's needed? We always want agreement. Then have them relax, go into a trance state, an insight state, a resource state, and go to the first position. Revivify that state. Quickly define the experience they had, then have them break the state. Open the eyes, mental saltine. Have them close the eyes again, go into the state again of learning, of insight, of getting along with others. And then move into the second perceptual position as the other person. Have them notice their own facial expressions. Have them notice their own tone of voice. Have them notice how they were in that situation from the perspective of the other person. Then have them break the state, again, open the eyes, mental saltine. And then process with them. What did you learn? Do an evaluation with them. Did they come to any new conclusions? You can even then have them go back into that resource state. Close the eyes, take in a breath. Move to the third perceptual position, a stranger in the room, or a fly on the wall. Have them look at new learnings from that perspective, new evaluations, new conclusions. Break the state. Again, open the eyes. And then process with them. Have them define new behaviors, new resources, new ideas. And this simple exercise in first, second, and third perceptual position can be a great learning experience for the vast majority of those who we apply it to. What is an ecology check? An ecology check in NLP is really the process at the end of any strategy of helping a client to define choices and actions and make sure that they fit their values and intentions. Ecology is about creating balance. Positive change sometimes has unintended consequences. For example, most of the alcoholics who I've worked with who were married ended up getting sober and divorced. It's interesting that divorce followed recovery more often than before recovery. 200 pounds of weight loss sounds awesome for the client who's 375 pounds, but it can lead to significant personality and social changes that they had not yet anticipated. An ecology check can use that third perceptual position, that dissociated state, to help a person envision what change will be like and evaluate new possibilities and new problems, or incongruence with parts of the plan that have conflicting outcomes. Here's an exercise that you can use to implement an ecology check pattern with your clients. First, have them identify a proposed change. I want to quit smoking, lose weight, stop chasing cars, whatever it is. Then have them dissociate into that third perceptual position. Ask them questions. What criteria, standards, parts, limitations, and feelings do they have about making the change and why they would make the change? Explore with them Cartesian coordinates. If I make the change, what will happen? If I make the change, what won't happen? If I make the change, what will happen? If I don't change, what will happen? Those four things. And this is a great exercise to guide somebody to in that third perceptual position where they can see a much larger surface area. This is an example of an ecology check pattern exercise. And when we have a client who comes to us unsure of what they do, for example, I have one right now who's trying to make a decision about this job or that job, this situation or that situation. Moving into the ecology check pattern as they choose to make decisions can help them to become congruent about the choices they make and the actions they take. These are some of the things that are related to neuro-linguistic programming and Ericksonian hypnosis. Just an overview. Again, I think some very important things, though. If you're interested in our full 30-hour NLP practitioner training program, we do offer that at subliminalscience.com, and you can always contact our office or visit our website for further information about that. You can also congratulate yourself. You've gone through 15 of these sessions. That's fantastic. And now it's time for session or lesson number 16.